Here are the highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. Visit freetalklive.com for the full episode.
In the outrageous category, the state of Maine, apparently the legislature there and the governor have signed and passed a new law that will, according to you, Mark, increase the minimum age of purchase and presumably possession of cigarettes. But I haven't read the story. So what's going on?
Yeah, I can't remember whether the possession part was part of the story or not. I read it a few days ago ahead of my show prep and brought it in. But yeah, it comes from WGME.com, which it appears as though WGME is on my side. So I'm sorry about that. He's not on your side. They're not on your side. Yeah. 13 on your side, WGME. Meaning me. At the State House Wednesday, lawmakers took up more than two dozen bills vetoed by the governor. One bill sought to prohibit the use of handheld phones and the other devices while driving. The governor says he vetoed this bill because it already has a law against texting and driving. Huh. The Senate vetoed to override. Voted to override, but the House sustained the governor's veto. This will not become law. The bill's sponsor calls that a mistake. Late Wednesday, the House and Senate voted to override the governor's veto of a bill to change the age you can buy tobacco products in Maine from 18 to 21.
I haven't seen the text of the law itself, but it's saying here the legal age for smoking is now 21 there. That suggests that it is also the legal age to possess the cigarettes as well. So wow. Anybody who, again, I haven't seen the text of the bill, but it would seem unusual for them to say, oh, well, it's illegal for you to buy it at age 20, but you can have them and smoke them at age 20.
Yeah, having a bill that says you got to get your friends to buy you cigarettes just doesn't make a whole
right.
lot of
so
sense.
So I suspect they're going to be prohibiting possession of cigarettes as well for people under the age of 21, which is going to result in police likely stopping all young people on the streets of Maine and demanding to see identification. And then if they are below the age of 21, proceeding to either ticket or arrest them for possession of cigarettes.
I guess I question this. As a youngster, I smoked plenty. A lot of my cigarette smoking went on prior to the age of 18, and no one had anything to say about it. I never had a problem with a police officer. Not to say that I spent a lot of time around them, and I'm sure that if I did, I put my cigarette out and hid it from them. But smoking when you're below the legal age seems to be something that's very doable.
According to the story I have here, they have, per your suggestion, Melanie, or not that you suggested this, but you suggested this might be the intention behind their bill, that they've made it illegal for people under the age of 21 to purchase tobacco. However, they're in the amended version of the bill, which presumably is the one that passed, it exempts people who are already 18 to 20 years old from this requirement, and implementation is delayed until July 2018. So if you're 17 right now, or maybe 17 in July 2018, then sorry, you won't be able to buy any cigarettes at age 18, 19, or 20. But if you're 18 when this law goes into effect, you'll be in the grace period of where it'll still, I guess, you'll be able to buy the cigarettes.
This is how they did it with alcohol, too. There was basically they lowered the age, raised the age of purchasing alcohol from 19 to 21. Mm-hmm. But if you had been able to purchase alcohol up to this point, then we don't want to disturb your habit, so we're not going to go and change anything for you.
Yeah, they don't want to deal with an entire state of withdrawing, 18-year-olds all at the same time. And they get less resistance this way. If they were going to take it away from people who already had it, not that people don't already have an underage, but those people who are now doing nothing would have resisted this.
They might have been more likely to, at least, sure.
So this isn't them being nice and not wanting people to withdraw. This is them knowing what they're doing.
That's an important thing. Whatever the program is you're running for Bitcoin, maybe it's not the complicated one that he's talking about where you're running a full node and you have to have the whole 150 gigabyte and constantly growing blockchain on your computer. Most people can't do that. They don't have the space. They don't have the interest. They don't have the technical know-how to get it set up. But the wallets that you get on your phone, the real basic, simple send-receive Bitcoin wallets, and there's a zillion of them, most all of the good ones have a way to back up your wallet information, and you always want to do that, because if something happened to, and you want to do it right away, because you never know. You might download a Bitcoin wallet, put your Bitcoin in it, and then 10 minutes later, you break the phone. So you need to back up your wallet as soon as possible. Speaking of Bitcoin, we were just talking with David there about the more complicated Bitcoin wallets, which are like the what they call full node wallets. He's using Bitcoin Unlimited. That's actually the one I'm running here in the studio for a full node. But the average Bitcoin user doesn't need to get this deep into Bitcoin. In fact, there's not really any real benefit that directly accrues to somebody who's using the full node software. It's just if you want to support the Bitcoin network with an extra data point, essentially, an extra storage point. Because what makes Bitcoin special is it's decentralized. It's unique in the world because it was the first decentralized cryptocurrency to ever hit the market. And that's why it's still number one today, because it's got that momentum behind it. But in order for it to be decentralized, then this thing called the blockchain, which is the ledger, this distributed public ledger that exists out there, it's also decentralized. So it exists in thousands of locations all around the globe simultaneously.
And at the same time.
And it's being updated all around the globe. Whenever a new transaction is sent, it propagates throughout that entire network. And so if one node is taken offline, or even dozens of nodes were taken offline, the ledger's still there, because again, there are thousands of people who are running this full node software, including the LRN studio. So that's what's important. It's important to have these nodes, but it's not important to, you know, 90% of the Bitcoin users out there. Most people just want to have a wallet where they can send and they can receive Bitcoin.
I was just curious what the advantages of running your own node, and if you're running your own node, does that mean you're a miner? And if you're not a miner, what's the difference? And
good question.
I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. You're welcome to stay, but whatever. So
it's an old talk radio thing. I don't know why some people do it, but that's what they do. So
if you're running a node, you're not a miner.
Right.
The miners are separate from the nodes. And no, I can't really say there is any direct benefit to the node user, the person who's running the full node.
I run a full one.
It's just for the
sometimes.
Love of Bitcoin. It's just for the you know, the support of the network. So only a fanatic is going to run a full node, because there's no, you know, you don't get paid for it or anything like that. Then as far as mining is concerned,
it increases the resilience of the Bitcoin network.
Sure.
Is probably the best thing you
it
can
has
say.
To have full nodes in order for it to be an effective network. No doubt about it. And
now,
resilient.
Miners run full nodes, but full nodes aren't necessarily miners. Does that make sense?
That sounds correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
the miners get paid because they're doing, you know, real hard work. It costs a lot of electricity to do that. With a full node, it's not going to take up that much of your computer's processing power, and it's going to take some bandwidth. I don't actually know how much bandwidth it takes up. I don't suspect it's that much, because it's just, you know, transactions coming in on a network.
I don't think the bandwidth, but it's
a network.
I mean, for an older computer, if you're going to dedicate an older computer to a node, it's going to eat up that hard drive pretty
quick. The hard drive is the thing that it's really costly on. It's right now 150 gigabytes for the blockchain. Here's a story from nhtechhub.com. They've been getting some press this week. This story, actually, according to Derek Janus, doesn't say here who the author is, but he says the author of this story, interestingly, is a city council member who wrote this for NH Tech Hub. Headline: New Hampshire's first retail store accepting cryptocurrency exclusively. With a soft opening in July. By the way, their grand opening's coming up next month, I believe September 9th.
Oh, man.
Retail store owner, me too. Retail store owner Steven Zeiler set out to do something a bit different in the popular retail destination of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He launched what he believes to be New Hampshire's and possibly the country's first retail store.
World.
No, it's not the world.
No?
First retail store to only accept cryptocurrency as payment. The Free State Bitcoin Shop is located at 56 State Street in Portsmouth, near popular Prescott Park. The small space is outfitted with local handcrafted items, books, pins, and promotional materials promoting New Hampshire, liberty, and various forms of digital currency. Also sold at the space are t-shirts, mostly promoting science, crypto, and politics. The most popular items are the t-shirts with slogans such as, "Not my president," and "Act in defiance, embrace science." Another popular and hilarious item is the Doge pillow, fashioned after the popular Doge meme dog. Steve says that many curious shoppers are surprised that they're not able to spend their U.S. dollars.
Sorry, we don't want that crap.
That's right. Now, Isn't that illegal? Isn't this civil disobedience? Really? So wait, legal tender laws no longer force people to accept
The federal one, I'm pretty sure, has been repealed. I'd kind of be surprised if New Hampshire had one.
Yeah, I don't suspect think New this is about it. As legal as trimming the wick on your lantern too low or something. I mean, like, it's a law that is just
it's
irrelevant.
Not enforced. Yeah.
You know, whether...
But doesn't the Federal Reserve note say that this is legal tender for all debts?
Public and private? Right.
Yeah, I haven't looked that closely at a dollar.
So they're just
I'm
BSing.
That a Secret Service agent, if they had the time, the energy, and the inclination, could come and make a stink at this store. And I would like to invite any and all Secret Service agents that are listening right now, please do this and tell Free Talk Live ahead of time so we can get the exclusive.
You know what? I don't know if this legally constitutes a store because according to the United States federal government, crypto is an asset, not a currency.
So they're trading is what
yes.
you're saying. But wait a minute. Aren't there two federal opinions about this? There's FinCEN and then there's the IRS. FinCEN says it is currency. The IRS says it's a commodity or something like that?
Virtual
commodity.
Is that
what you were thinking of, the IRS opinion on it?
The IRS said that it's an asset. If I trade you 10 Federal Reserve notes for a sandwich, that's taxable. You would have to pay taxes on $10. If I trade you a $10 book for a $10 sandwich,
not taxable.
I'm not sure.
It's reportable, but it's not taxable.
I used to, a radio station for whom I used to work down in Sarasota, Florida, had an account with an organization that was a barter exchange.
International Barter Exchange.
And they.
Didn't they have a jingle?
I don't know, but they did come up with, at the end of the year, they had a tax form, and you had to fill it out regarding how much trade you used. So there's some effect that I can't really...
Okay, so if you have a gain, it's taxable.
Okay.
But if you're trading an equal amount, an equal value... So if I'm if I go and trade $3 worth of Bitcoin for a thing that is worth $3, there's no gain for anybody. Now, there later on, you're going to have issues when you convert it to Federal Reserve
notes. If you sell it. Yeah. Mark, where did you come across this story about the last blockbuster on Twitter?
Are you familiar with Imgur, imgur.com?
Yeah. Lots of memes up there.
I found it there, and, you know, I am an account holder, one of us. And, you know, I just started scrolling through, thought it was interesting, and there it was.
It's at Lone Blockbuster, at L-O-N-E, Lone Blockbuster on Twitter. And you want to share a couple, a few
Sure,
of
no
their
problem.
Tweets?
I've got, we love your replies, but unfortunately, replies don't pay the rent. Just a reminder, VCR rentals will not fit through our quick drop box return slot, no matter how hard you kick them. Okay, thanks.
It sounds like somebody who probably did work at a video store at some point.
Yeah. We're watching Titanic, and the boobs part starts in like 15 minutes if you guys want to get down here. Yep. Here at Blockbuster, we have one motto. If the hot oil from our popcorn machine scalds you, you get 25% off of any candy purchase. Sometimes we get excited when cars pull into our lot, but it turns out it's just divorced parents passing along their children to each other.
For families across the United States, this is from Samantha Schmidt at the Washington Post, driving to the local Blockbuster video was a Friday night ritual. You remember this growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
The kids fought over which movies to rent, parents had to pay off the late fees, and all succumbed to the popcorn and candy buckets at the register. Blockbuster once operated 9,000 stores nationwide, bringing in $6 billion in annual revenue at its peak.
Oh, yeah.
In 1989, a new Blockbuster was opening every 17 hours.
But, and with that, I'd like to remind you, Netflix doesn't even have any stores.
That's true. But the image of the blue and yellow ticket stub logo now merely evokes nostalgia and memories of a time before Netflix, before online streaming, and before some laptops eliminated DVD players altogether. After a long decline, the video rental business declared bankruptcy, and its new parent company, Dish Network, began closing all of the remaining retail locations in 2013. So yeah, it was about 4 years ago when that happened. And, you know, I know Blockbuster did get into the Netflix competition business for a while. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, they were sending out videos.
And I thought, you know, this was a smart move on their part to try to kind of stay relevant. And
not smart enough,
I guess. Yeah, it wasn't enough to defeat Netflix.
Hey, Daily Digest listeners. If you're like me, then you really enjoy Free Talk Live and the Message of Liberty. Yet you may not always have the time to listen to an episode of Free Talk Live. So, you listen to the Digest instead. If you enjoy the Digest, please donate $5 to $10 per month to patreon.com/crblake86. That's patreon.com/crblake86. You can also donate with Bitcoin or Ether. See the show notes for further details.
Speaking of Netflix, you guys do realize that Blockbuster started Netflix. It started with, like, a couple of envelopes on the door. Yeah. Like, when you...
Well, they started a service like Netflix. They didn't start Netflix.
But it started with an envelope when people couldn't show up after certain hours. You know, that's a true story.
You're saying that people would leave their videos in an envelope at the Blockbuster?
Yeah, that's how it started.
Okay, I've never heard of that. I know they had
I think you just slide it through the little
slot. Yeah, they had the slot where you just threw stuff through a slot. You didn't need to put it in an envelope.
Yeah, the difference was, you know, Netflix had the advantage to, you know, go online, go on the internet and sell, right? They had a stock, they have everything, and look where they are today, right?
Yeah, I think the biggest advantage they had is they didn't have to pay, they didn't have to pay high school kids to mess up the alphabetical order thing. They didn't have to,
pay for retail space.
Yeah, the whole deal there.
Right, look where they are today. Right,
Netflix. They're doing amazing. They have 100+ million subscribers in the U.S. or something like that.
Doing their own programming.
Or I don't know if it's global or if it's U.S., but there are a lot of subscribers to Netflix. For me, I understand that Netflix is, like, they're really good at doing the streaming thing and everything, but I would rather watch a movie on a Blu-ray just because the quality, I think, is going to be better.
But don't they have, like, HD stuff?
Yeah, they've got HD streaming. No, they do. They have HD streaming. That's what you're asking about. But the bit rate of the Blu-ray is going to be higher. You're going to get a higher video quality. For somebody like me, I'm the kind of person who had a Laserdisc player in the 1990s, so I was always more interested in the better quality kind of movie presentation. And if you've got a disc, you're never going to have unless the disc is scratched, you're never going to have a problem with buffering or, you know, dropouts because of Wi-Fi connection.
You're always going to have that crisp look.
Correct.
For what you want.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting your use of the writing on the wall. Many people talk about this as predicting the future.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of how you used it. But in this case, it's absolutely correct. So the writing on the wall is a Old Testament story where a disembodied hand comes in front and writes, right in front of King Belshazzar. Meeny, meeny, tekel, and pharsay. And it means you have been weighed and found wanting, and that's absolutely true
about physical media stores.
And physical media, right? Like, you have been weighed and found wanting. First, I've got to say, you're thrifty. You spend very little money on yourself.
That's true. Like, it's true. $10 a month isn't a big deal.
Right. Like, I mean, you know, for you, splurging is like, wow, I need to have, I put a filter on my water faucet, right? Like, you're not a big splurger, and you don't, you're rather ascetic in the way that you live your life.
Yep, that's
so
true.
If you want to continue paying $10 a month
for nothing,
to have DVDs shipped to you if you were to watch them, but you haven't watched
one in 8 months.
I
probably watch
an
average of like 4 a year or something like that.
I must, I'm going to go ahead and recommend that you spend your money differently, but I acknowledge that you are really good with your money, so anything
but Melanie's
you
right.
To,
I could totally
well, yeah,
like
no, I'm not saying don't blow $10 a month, but it would just really bother me to know that I had dropped almost $100 on a movie. And
that
then
you can't even keep.
Yeah, that I'm spending $10 a month on nothing. Like, that would bother me. So...
Yeah, and it looks like the one before that was about a month before that. So Not really worth it. But anyway, back to the story here from Blockbuster, or about Blockbuster, the remaining 10. And if you actually go to Blockbuster.com, they really do have a link on the top right, find Blockbuster store locations, where it just gives you a list
of all the stores.
They don't have to, you don't have to have a finder or a thing where you click on the state or anything like that. It's just a straight up list of the 10 remaining Blockbuster. Alaska's cold, long, dark winters also lend themselves to plenty of in-home entertainment. The most profitable Blockbuster store is in bitterly cold Fairbanks, where the temperatures can reach 50 below zero. Most of Payne's managers have remained in their roles for at least a decade, riding out the wave of closures and declining sales. He says if any of them were to leave now, it would be impossible for me to go out and hire a new management team. Because who the hell would want to get a job?
Would.
Right. Who would want to go and apply for a job at a Blockbuster video store, knowing that, you know, this is not
going to
be a
career? I mean, would you even want to hire anybody who is currently applying at Blockbuster?
Yeah, it's not going to be a career. You know, how long is it going to last is really the only question. He says they love the business and they want to see it to the end. What has kept his managers around for so long is what has kept Blockbuster alive, the interaction with customers. Quote, there's not a whole lot of retail businesses that people go to because they truly want to. When you went on a Friday or Saturday night just to rent the movie or to rent a movie, that was just fun, he said. In fact, more than half of Blockbuster's revenue is generated during the six-hour period on Friday nights. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
Payne said that most of our people remember those days, and it's still fun to be there on a weekend.
There are companies now that look like monoliths, and Blockbuster must have, opening a store every 17 minutes. I don't think that people were really prepared to predict the demise of this retail behemoth at that time. But, I mean, and right now...
You mean in 1989?
Well, but the tech that would have overtaken it didn't exist at that time, and when it did start to exist, they didn't get on board.
Right. I mean, they...
Well, they did, but it...
They did, but they just didn't... They had all that overhead.
Yeah, it was just too much to cover, the costs of running those stores.
Yeah, but
the
they
employees.
Never had a... Did they ever have a online streaming site? I don't think they did.
Oh, no online streaming.
So right, so that's...
But they were losing the rental, the movie rental business, too. Netflix already had that wrapped up by the time Blockbuster really got into it.
Yeah, well, what I was saying that they did have was they had to ship the DVD in the mail thing like Netflix right. did in the beginning. And I don't know when Blockbuster got into that to compete with Netflix, but it might have been a little bit late.
It clearly
I mean,
wasn't
and
soon
Netflix
enough.
Netflix in the beginning didn't make any sense. Like, okay, order a DVD online.
Why not?
We'll mail it to you.
It made a lot of sense. That's why
because
they...
at the time you could drive down to the store and get it right now.
But the reason why it made sense was because it was more convenient. Because then they didn't have to drive
How
down to the store.
How on earth is that more convenient?
It comes in your mailbox. You walk to the mailbox rather than having to get in the car and go down to the store. There's a reason why they became the most successful company.
Yeah, because they went to online streaming.
They got there because they made probably billions of dollars sending product through the mail. I was looking to see... Here it is. July 2017, Netflix has 103.95 million subscribers worldwide, including almost 52 million in the United States. So a good sixth of the population of the United States has an account with Netflix.
And then another sixth has somebody else's login.
That's probably true as well.
Well, they let you have like...
They let you share logins?
There's a cap on how many users you can have.
Okay.
And different plans like give you different amounts of users. Like... I knew somebody who had three, so you could have at least three on whatever plan they had.
Yeah, so if you were willing to plan ahead and you knew the movies you wanted to see at some point, they just all come to you in a queue and you could have as many movies as you wanted and you never had to go back to the movie store, no late fees.
I hear you.
So
yeah, the store sounds, and I know that I'm comparing everything kind of to the internet because that's what there was pretty much when I was 18, but the store sounds better to me than... ordering discs through the mail.
You had wanted to talk about a tragic story about somebody who is a supposed U.S. citizen held in a immigration detention center warehouse holding zone for 3 years of the person's life?
Yes. So he was a U.S. citizen. He was a U.S. citizen when he got arrested.
Still is, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It sounds to me, based on the story from NPR... that his felony triggered, because he had a drug felony, which is, by federal law, anything that you can get sentenced to a year or more. So
okay.
Most drug crimes. triggered an immigration investigation.
And he was coming back in from somewhere when this happened?
No, he was in the States.
Oh, okay.
He never left.
Okay.
Because that's why they didn't stop him at the border. He wasn't at an airport, and he had just been convicted or just got out. He hadn't just been convicted.
Oh, my God.
He just got out of jail. So it sounds to me like that triggered ICE. I don't know that. They didn't say that. ICE isn't admitting that. Based on what I know about how it works, that's what it sounds like to me. So they went and arrested him. He said he was a citizen. He continued saying he was a citizen for 3 years. They looked up the name of somebody who he told him what whose father's name was. They looked up somebody who had a similar name to his father and found out that that other person, unrelated, wasn't a citizen. Never looked into it further. He attached his father's naturalization documents.
He did all this from inside prison or inside a detention center?
Detention center, yes.
I called in those mailboxes to Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. It's called Consumer Affairs. And I told them how when you stand there to check your mail, the cars are going by you. And if they're texting, talking on cell phone, they could hit you.
Okay, you're talking about the... I'm sorry, I had to kind of refresh my mind of what you were referring to, and I was able to recollect that you're calling about an issue that you consider to be very important, and that is that people who are standing in front of the blue boxes, so the U.S. Postal Service has blue boxes that they put out in various different locations. Some of them are on the sides of roads, and you know, the idea is that a person in a car can drive up with their driver's side window and they can drop their mail into the slot and then just drive along, and they don't have to actually get out of their car. And you're saying that if you stand there as not a person who's in a car, but just a person just standing there, that is a risky thing, and you're concerned about that?
No, I was talking about these mailboxes where people get their mail living in apartment complexes.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. All right. So you're saying that in apartment complexes, the mailbox areas are placed in dangerous locations where people could get hit?
Right, and I called them. What they have told me is they want to make it accessible to the handicapped.
Mm.
So the whole deal was that the wheelchair people can roll up to be able to check their mail.
You just heard highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. You can download full episodes, subscribe to our podcast, listen live, and more, all for free at freetalklive.com.